طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. It is just over a year since the Israeli military assassinated Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, an iconic journalist who covered Palestine for Al Jazeera. Although an American citizen, the United States has refused to investigate the murder. Israel has claimed it will not support such an investigation. A meticulous, independent investigation has been conducted by the local media and has reported incontrovertible evidence that an Israeli sniper shot Shireen, even though she wore a jacket indicating in large letters that she was press. At the recent nationally televised White House Correspondents' Dinner, President Biden paid tribute to several foreign journalists who were killed this year while doing their job, yet did not even mention Shireen Abu Akleh, an American citizen journalist killed by Israel while on duty. Another example of the United States ignoring Israeli crimes and thereby supporting them. And the beat goes on. Today, This Week in Palestine features a conversation with Palestinian physician, author, journalist, and activist Gadi Karmi, speaking with the Electronic Intifada's Nora Barros Friedman and Asa Winstanley. Her seminal book, Searching for Fatima, is a memoir of her family's expulsion from their home in Palestine during the Nakba. It is a classic. Here is a conversation with Gadi Karmi.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Today, we're delighted to have author, academic, and physician Gadi Karmi back on the show to talk about the 75th anniversary of the beginning of the Nakba and her new book, One State, The Only Democratic Future for Palestine Israel. Karmi was born in Jerusalem and was among the 800,000 Palestinians who were forcibly expelled from Palestine in 1948. Gadi Karmi's work includes books that have been instrumental in both my and Asa's early political education, In Search of Fatima and Married to Another Man, and her new book, I'm sure, will join those earlier counterparts. Gadi Karmi, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Hello.
So before we get into your new book, which examines the one-state future in Palestine, we wanted to talk about the timing. We're up against the 75th year of the beginning of the Nakba, the act committed by Zionists of forced expulsion and ethnic cleansing of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in 1948 when Israel declared itself a state, an act that continues to this day. Can you talk about your experience of the Nakba? What happened to you and your family 75 years ago?
Well, you have to understand, first of all, that this, what I'm going to say, is is my view of things as a child. As a child who also did not understand what was going on. All that I knew was that, as from the beginning of 1948, schools were closed. My school was closed, so I couldn't go to school. I was a primary school at that time, but, you know, everything closed down. Increasingly, as the early months of 1948 advanced, more and more what I would call abnormalities crept into my life. So it's bad enough that I didn't go to school, but increasingly we were really restricted from going out at all, because there's a good reason for that. Jewish snipers had taken up positions inside empty houses, that is, houses whose families had already left, you know, thinking that, as you do in time of troubles, that to take the children away for safety. Now, those houses were used by these snipers, and they just... I mean, they shot at people walking along the street. So everybody scuttled in. For me, as a child, it wasn't that I really understood any of this, but I understood that my parents were scared. And that scared me. It was an inchoate fear. And so it went on getting more and more abnormal until April 1948, which is when my parents decided had to evacuate us to somewhere safe while, quote, things died down, unquote. And that was it. I never saw my homeland as it had been again. I've been back, but it's not the same place. So it's a very shocking, very traumatic. And I really think that Palestinians should face the fact that this was a massive trauma. And really, it's very difficult to recover from something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk a little bit about your house. You discovered almost 20 years ago that the New York Times was in, or rather on top of, your childhood home. You received a call from the Times bureau chief, Stephen Erlinger, in 2005. He read your memoir, In Search of Fatima, and invited you to visit your own home. Can you talk about that surreal experience and what it says about how Palestinian property and lives have been either erased as villages were razed, or up for grabs to foreign settlers and even bureau chiefs of a major news outlet?
That's right. And now, in fact, our house had been a villa, which is on one floor. There was no other floor. So at some subsequent point, somebody had built an upper story, and it became the New York Times bureau chief's residence in Jerusalem. What a coincidence. Now, Erlinger actually found my email address, don't know how, but he got in touch, and he said exactly that. I think I'm living above your house, etc. And would you like to come and visit? So I couldn't possibly have resisted, because I really had to see it. So I went, and... apart from actually going into the house, the thing that really was pretty striking was that Erlinger, was at pains to be nice to me and to admire, you know, praise my book and things like that, and then to tell me that the family, Israeli family, living in our house, are terribly nice people, and they really very understand, and they're very happy for you to look round. And I remember saying to him, hang on, you now know what you do know. You've read my memoir. You're now living above my old house, which has different people living in it. Has that changed your view of Israel at all? He looked embarrassed. He tried to change the subject. And in my conversation with him, again and again, I came back to this point. I said to him, you know what happened. Why do you not say, how is it possible that it wouldn't change your view of Israel? You can see you're here because I'm not here. So doesn't that mean anything? He was evasive to the end. And I did go and look at my house, which was not our house. I mean, it was dead, really. All the soul in it had gone. And these people were using it. They were nice enough. I'm not saying anything else, but it was really a very sad, uncomfortable experience for me.
The stories in your book in search of Fatima are so striking, and you're left with this immense sense of loss in your memoir. You know, this sort of stark facing up to the reality of a Palestine that is gone forever, in a sense that, you know, even should Palestine be restored at some point in the future, well, let's be optimistic and say when Palestine is restored at some point in the future, it won't be the same Palestine, and there's no going back in time, and that Palestine will, you know, in the future would be something different. So, I mean, on that note, let's get into your book, your new book. Here it is, One State, The Only Democratic Future for Palestine and Israel. And it's kind of an extension of an earlier book you wrote, Married to Another Man, on a similar topic. And it's not the first book on the One State Solution. And our colleague, Ali Abul Nema, of course, he wrote a book about 20 years ago. And you reference his work and the work of others extensively in your new book. And you write in the introduction, quote, a shared state is the only way this impasse will end, not because it is wanted by either side, but because it is inevitable. It is the contention of this book that the logic of the situation before us must lead to the formation of one democratic state in place of the current ethnocentric apartheid state of Israel. And you add at the end another quote, Israel was created and maintained against the logic of history, and the same historical logic will dictate its inevitable ending. So this is all from the introduction. So Rada, tell us a bit more about why you wrote this book and what the current moment can show us in terms of this inevitability that you talk about in the introduction.
Well, look, my primary motivation was knowing that the 75th anniversary of Israel was coming up, I actually wanted to look ahead, to look forward, rather than mourn the past. Of course we mourn the past, we always will. But really, it's high time that we used our energies to inquire, discuss, search for the future. For me, of course, and I think for all Palestinians, the future means the return of Palestine. Now, how that return will happen, what it will amount to, these are things that need to be addressed. And that was the primary motivation for the book. Now, when I said that it was inevitable, I really meant that. It wasn't wishful thinking. because it's in the logic of the situation that you have an oppressor who knows no other language except violence and oppression, and you have an oppressed people. And you can get away with this for a long time, and you can see Israel's done quite well in so many decades where it's been able to commit all kinds of crimes and get away with it. But it cannot go on forever. That situation does not go on forever. It never has historically. So that's what I meant by inevitable. Because the subject people rise up again and again, ineffectively at first, but as time goes on, they get more and more effective. And the oppressor, having no tools other than oppression, will increase their oppression. So that dialectic of even more violence from the oppressor and resistance by the oppressed will eventually lead to a very different and new situation. Now, of course, I do not suggest that when this happens and there is a sort of chaos, I'm not suggesting that suddenly out of this there will emerge this state quickly. It won't. There will be a period of bloodshed, of extreme chaos and violence. But then out of this will come the shape of the future state, a state which no way can it be a state for one side entirely, certainly not for Jews. And where, you know, Palestinians have to, as I've said in the book, you know, they have to accept, bitter as it is for them, that to live with what was the oppressor yesterday, people who have a racist attitude towards them and feel themselves to be superior, it's very, very difficult to get to people who've suffered so much to say, all right, I will live with you. But there is no alternative. There is a Jewish community living in what was Palestine. And what are you going to do with them? You're not going to kill them. You're not going to throw them in the sea. So, of course, you have to live together. What I'm suggesting, which most reasonable people would suggest, is the way you live together will be in a democracy where everybody is represented equally, irrespective of their origin, race, gender, etc.
One of the parallels that is often made, of course, is South Africa, but and there are, you know, there's certainly similarities. But what do you make of the less commonly made parallel of Algeria, where the what do you think of the similarities there? Do you see any similarities with what happened with Algeria, in the sense that the French settler colonists were offered citizenship in the liberated Algeria after they won their national liberation struggle, but hardly any of them chose to accept it.
It went back to France.
Yeah.
Actually, it's very interesting that, because you see, I do see a parallel, and I'll tell you what it is. First of all, don't forget that the French have a mother country. They do. And so when the Algerians made that very extremely generous offer, they knew that nobody was going to end up stateless. They would go back to France or wherever, because they still were French. They were still French. So that's one difference, let's say, between our situation in Israel. But where I see the similarity is that a large number of these French colonists who had been, settlers really, decided to leave and to go and find their lives elsewhere.
You see, their colonial privilege was more important to them.
Absolutely. But this is exactly the point of similarity with the situation in Israel, because what you have are people who have grown accustomed to enjoying all the advantages of colonialism without the cost. I mean, wonderful. Where else are they going to get that? Now, when the Arabs, as they call them, come along and say, okay, let's live together in equality, it's anathema to many of people like this on the Jewish side. Anathema. They despise Arabs. They look down on them. The idea that they would live with them in equality is absolutely abhorrent. They would leave. That's my point. We're not asking for anybody to leave, but that is what would in effect happen. People with dual nationality will try and make their way back to Western countries. And that will leave behind, as I've explained in the book, a population of poor Jews, religious Jews, and hardy souls who refuse to accept what's happening and hang on in the hope that it will change. That's what I think will happen.
The two-state solution, meanwhile, is still paraded about by Western leaders as a way to kick the can down the road, continue the status quo. How can you assess its popularity by civil society at this point in time? And what will it take for this charade to finally be put to rest?
Yes, thank you for asking that. That's a very important and interesting question. You see, you have to ask what's really going on when a political solution was proposed decades ago and got nowhere on the ground. But on the contrary, the conditions for its realization have vanished because there's not enough land left. The land is not contiguous. And so it's even on those grounds alone, it's not doable. However, as you say, people cling to it, particularly Western leaderships, Western politicians. They cling to this for dear life. Now, what is that about? Well, I think it's about, firstly, it's easier. It's easier for these people rather than confront what they've helped create in the Middle East, a state like Israel, rather than confront that and understand that that has consequences. You see, if you go on talking about two states, then the aggrieved party, the Palestinians, gets something and would be induced to keep quiet. And Israel can carry on as usual, although in a smaller geographical space, let's say. So that's very, very attractive, the idea of that. And that's what actually made it so popular from the beginning, that you could preserve this Zionist state and at the same time do something for the Palestinians so that they would stop getting together and doing intifadas and all these nasty things. So I think really that's what it was. However, I do feel there's something deeper than that, because you have to ask, all right, well, if that's fine for the reasons I've just said, you Western politicians, you wanted, you support two states, fine. Now I'm demonstrating to you that it cannot physically happen. Just like, you know, you might say, I would like to have a Rolls Royce. And the answer comes back after a while, you're dreaming of this Rolls Royce. And the answer comes back, no, not available. They don't make them anymore. And you go on saying, but I tell you, I want a Rolls Royce. Now, what's that about?
God promised me a Rolls Royce, right?
Even better, yes. But you see, I really think there's something psychological at the bottom of this. And I think Palestinians have to wise up. because something that is that Westerners cling to like this, despite the evidence, against the evidence, despite the injustice, all that stuff. What I think, and of course it's a suspicion, I can't prove it, is that deep inside, a lot of Europeans and Americans is an abiding sense of guilt about the Jews. Now, that's because, of course, the culmination of that was in the Holocaust, but it was before, in the historic persecution of Jews. That remains deeply inside a lot of people, and they feel badly about Jews. And they feel that the Jews, the least you can do is help them to live in their state, make sure that they're safe. I really cannot think of any other than this explanation. You can see that if something, I mean, they're not conscious of this. I'm not suggesting for a moment they're going around thinking this, but that's what I think animates this very strange phenomenon.
You talk a lot in your book. There's a really the longest chapter really is about a kind of history of different plans for Palestine, different plans of what's often called the one state solution. And you also talk about the binational state and how, you know, I find the section quite interesting where you're talking about some of the early Zionists were wanted to have a binational state within Palestine as a way really of having a foothold for their colonial project, really. There's also something called parallel sovereignty. You write in your book that you're not trying to make a blueprint, but could you maybe talk a little bit about the evolution of the one state idea and its history, and where do you think we've got to now?
Well, as you say, that chapter I felt it was very important for people to understand how these ideas have evolved. And they really have. I would say in the last 20 years, the idea of a democratic state, a one person, one vote state, has acquired much more prominence. It's not, unfortunately, it's not taken hold of opinion formers, of leaderships in the West, as it should have done. And that, again, just I refer to my earlier answer about the two states, because of this deep guilt that then if you have a one democratic state, that's the end of Israel, actually. That is something that there is a kind of a revulsion against. Anyway, despite that, the discussion of the one state, democratic state, has increased over the last 20 years as a number of groups have come into being, trying to make it happen, and increasingly so, you know, but so really that I think is how it's happening. A binational state does not solve this problem because, well, first of all, the implication that you've got the idea is that you've got two equivalent nations, as it were, with equivalent rights. And each community or each nation, quote, looks after itself, and is sort of autonomous, with a kind of joint parliament for defense or things like that. It won't work, you see, it's not desirable. I'll tell you why, because the national, the Israel national state, half of this binationalism would be Zionist. I mean, you know, there's no escaping from the fact that Zionism has to end.
A binational state would also be sectarian. It would be a sectarian state. And, you know, we see the problems inherent in such an idea in a country like Lebanon, especially.
Absolutely. And in fact, when I've, you know, been through, I've described various models of countries that have got different communities. Belgium is a very good example. The fact is, if you're lucky, people can tolerate it and can get on. But more often than not, the whole thing breaks down. Now, in the case of Palestine, which has no equivalent, in my view, it has no precedent, it has no equivalent. It's really unique. We are discovering as we go along, and we're, you know, searching for a way out of this hideous tragedy. So there's a limit. What I'm trying to say is there's a limit to how much one can apply other models. And you quite rightly raised the question of South Africa. And of course, one of the most important reasons why the situation in South Africa and in Palestine are fundamentally different is that the people who practiced apartheid, they wanted to exploit the blacks, to use them for all kinds of lowly paid laboring, etc., all these jobs. In the case of Palestine, the Zionists wanted to replace the Palestinians, want to expel them. They don't want them around at all, serving them or not serving them. So that's a very, very fundamental difference.
Liberal Zionists who decry the current outwardly fascistic government in Israel, you know, mourning the loss of, in quotations, Israel's soul, which of course has always been a deranged fantasy. They say that the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement is worthless, that international solidarity movements are hopeless, and that the only actors who can bring so-called peace and security, of course, for Israel are international governments and courts and the powerful elite. What's missing from that equation, and how important are solidarity movements and the boycott movement and, you know, people who take direct action to stop Israel's crimes?
Well, let me answer the last bit of your point. The BDS movement, the solidarity movement for Palestine, direct action, whichever way people feel that they can express this, is very valuable. It's very important for the Palestinians. The problem with the liberal Zionists is that they don't actually, whatever they say, they don't care about Palestinians. They like to appear civilized and humane, and you know, we don't want to oppress anybody. But actually, if they thought about who Palestinians are and what they've been through, they could not adhere to the policies of a state which created all of that and which perpetuates it. So whether they're liberal and they appreciate art or something, it is really irrelevant for the Palestinians. It's quite useless. And in a way, you know, I have to tell you, liberal Zionists are a menace. They are a menace because they perpetuate this false presentation of Israel as some kind of civilized place, which, you know, appeals to Western liberal sensibilities, who think, well, these are really nice people, actually, and the state is quite nice, but they've got a bad government, for example, you know. Right. And you hear this a lot. So they really are a menace. In a way, I have to say to you that Smotrich and et al. Are a breath of fresh air.
They're more honest. Absolutely. The mask is off. Exactly.
Yeah, they're saying the quiet part out loud.
Right. Right. It's incredible. What do you see as the role of the so-called international community in terms of the single state inevitability?
I'm afraid that the international community, so-called, has been extremely disappointing where the Palestinians are concerned. Every time Israel commits a crime, and many of these crimes have been massive against an innocent population, the international community is absent. It does nothing. It doesn't matter what it says. It just doesn't do anything. And you see, I came to the conclusion that Palestinians, in order to have a future, have to do away with these illusions. There is no international community as far as they're concerned. There is no Western government which cares a hang about them. And therefore, they're on their own. And they've very often relied on international law, on the United Nations, the various sections of the United Nations. But it's never changed anything. Things just go on getting worse. So that's why I feel very strongly they have to take matters into their own hands. And if they do, it'll make a real difference. It's the only thing that will.
So finally, what are the obstacles to the one-state solution, and do you think it can happen within our lifetime?
Well, if one looks at the book, I have talked about one possible route to the one-state, and that is through a Palestinian demand for equal rights. Now, if you think about that, that's actually not only important, but could be very effective. Currently, the one territory, the territory between the river and the sea, is one state. Israel rules it. Now, about half of the people it rules are Jews, and the other half are Palestinians. So it is already a population which has a significant split down the middle. Now, I have argued that if the Palestinian half, which is the one without rights, without state, it's stateless, without nationality, that half should demand equal rights with the rest of the citizens that Israel rules. That, to my mind, that is the first step. It's comprehensible. It's not difficult to. It's not difficult to support. There are precedents for equal rights in recent Western history. There's nothing bizarre about a demand like that, and nobody is attacking anybody. This is not violent. It's asking that if it's making the point that if you, Israel or any other power, is ruling a people, you cannot do that without giving them any rights whatsoever, which is what's happening. Now, I feel quite strongly that if the Palestinians really set up a big campaign demanding equal rights, Israel has to react one way or the other. It has to ignore it, or it has to it has to become more repressive, and the whole thing is out in the open. So I really feel something like that has to happen. Unfortunately, your question is very good, Asa, because unfortunately, I don't have confidence that Palestinians will want to do this for the reasons we said before. They don't want to live with these oppressors. They really don't. This is a very big problem. So what will happen? Well, as I describe in my book, and as I said earlier, there's a logic to this. Whatever you might want as Israel, and whatever the Palestinians might imagine that they can get, it won't happen like this. It will only happen when there has been sufficient social unrest amongst Palestinians. And this is a very powerful weapon, because quite a few of them are living inside Israel, and the rest are living just literally, well, it is part of the old Palestine. So they're not far away. I'm talking about them. I'm not talking about people like me. They, if they all rose up as they did in 2021, if you remember, May 2021, very significant 11 days, in my opinion. They rose up together. This was really very striking. In 1948, in the West Bank and Gaza, in East Jerusalem, and us outside. This is really something. And that's going to happen again.
Yeah, it was kind of unprecedented. I mean, it's not completely unprecedented for the whole of Palestine to rise up together, but I can't think of a similar moment, really, since 1936, really, when it was the whole of Palestine unified like that in the same way. I mean, yes, during the Second Intifada, there was some protests within 1948 territory, and they were brutally repressed. You know, there was Palestinians in 48 inside present day Israel who were killed for protesting in solidarity with the Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza. But your final chapter in the book is on that and the significance of that. Sort of what some people called the Unity Intifada, kind of uprising all together, and it broke down the barriers imposed by Israel in that way.
Yep, and I think that's going to happen again, and we'll gain momentum because that is the way things work out. Once people have risen, and the cause for their uprising remains the same or actually gets worse. They're not, all the conditions are there again. And so it will be like that. Now, when you say, will it be in our lifetimes? I have to tell you, I really, really want it to happen in our lifetimes. Here's a personal confession. I cannot bear the idea of going to my grave with this horrendous injustice thriving and the state of Israel, the apartheid, ethnic cleansing state of Israel, prospering. I can't. Either I'm never going to die or that the situation will have to change drastically. But seriously speaking, I do not think it will be very long. I really don't, because situations like this are unstable and they will erupt again and again. And each eruption has an effect. So it's a bit like that, really.
Gada Karmi, thank you so much for all of the work that you do. Your new book is brilliant and invaluable. It's called One State, the Only Democratic Future for Palestine. Israel will have links to that, to the book and how you can get it on the podcast post that accompanies this episode. Gada Karmi, thank you so much. And thanks for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
You have been listening to a conversation with Palestinian physician, author, and activist Gada Karmi, with the Electronic Intifada's Nora Barrows Friedman and Asa Winstanley. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on KKRN.org, that's KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the Internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.